And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Peter Fitzsimons. Peter is Australia's best-selling non-fiction writer, and for 30 years has been a journalist and columnist for the Sydney Morning Herald and the Sun Herald. He's the author of a canon of books, including biographies as varied as Sir Douglas Mawson and Nick Farr-Jones. On the sporting field, Peter played rugby for several years in Italy and France and reached the highest level in Australia when he played for the Wallabies. Peter's latest book, Breaker Morant, is epic in scope, and it covers in detail the real story of a romantic figure from the earliest days of our country becoming a nation. He was last on this program in 2012 when we spoke about his biographical work, A Simpler Time. Peter, welcome back to Dads on the Air.
Bill, nice to be here. Thank you, and thank you for that kind introduction. Yeah, if I might say, it was quite the effort to get to the bottom of the Breaker Morant story. Can I ask you, as one who's read the book, and you're one of the first I've talked to, what's your thought?
Someone described it as a complex story, and and it certainly is that. I mean, you can give all sorts of descriptions to Breaker Morant, and I'd probably like to give another one. It's absolutely fascinating because it brings in the history of Australia, it brings in the history of South Africa. You've given a really good history of South Africa. Yep. And then we get on to Breaker Morant himself and what a complicated figure he is. It must have been very hard to find out the truth of what was going on.
I'm glad you picked that up. I mean, did you find it a page-turner, may I ask?
Absolutely. It's the characters and the personalities come out, and I suppose at the end of it, I've still got a few questions, but
I want to answer them. I'd say that is, but I'm interested that, if you picked up on that, the way I write, a lot of people think history and they think history classes and they go, that was boring and, memorising dates. And what I want to do with all my books, my instruction to my researchers is I want the FD, the fine detail, to make the whole thing, L and B, live and breathe. So when I started out writing books, I wanted to, gather next to me at the campfire and I'll tell you a great story. I no longer want that. I don't want there to be a campfire. I don't want to be in it. I want to write it in a manner that the reader is in it, is right there, that understands the emotions, so that it reads like a work of fiction, like a novel, but it's backed up by 2,000 footnotes saying, I'm not making this up. This is what happened. And with Breaker Morant, I might say, it was a very difficult exercise because he was an absolutely inveterate liar, and he established layer upon layer of lies about what he did and why he did it and how he did it and where he was that have been repeated many, many times over the last 100 years. And when you go back to the original documentation, you're saying, well, hang on, that's actually not the way it happened. That's not what it was about. So to get to the core of the man, I was quite shocked by the atrocities with his name in the bottom right-hand corner of them. And when the last book I did was James Cook. One of the roles I have is I'm chair of the Australian Republic Movement. I very much believe in Australian identity is important. And in many ways, to have written James Cook and found James Cook to be a mongrel dog would have been much easier. It would have been sort of, fitted. But that's not what I found. I didn't find James. I thought James Cook was obviously a great navigator, but a fundamentally decent man. And whereas Breaker Morant, it would have suited me if he was the man from Snowy River, cruelly put up against the wall by those British bastards who unfairly court-martialed him and shot him. And the answer is, well, he wasn't. Breaker Morant was not that. For a start, he was an Englishman himself, only came to Australia in his early 20s. Secondly, he was responsible for the shooting of unarmed Boer prisoners and establishing a culture whereby basically what was done on his watch were the worst atrocities done against the Boers or by either side during that Boer War.
I wonder if we could just go back to when he did arrive in Australia and he established a name for himself around the country and he even met Banjo Paterson.
He met Banjo Paterson, and the something that many of your listeners may not know. I certainly had no idea of it. He married. The marriage didn't last long, but he married none other than Daisy Bates, who later came to fame as a pioneer in the work of working with the people of the First Nations, studying them, helping them. And, you know, she's a famous figure in Australian history. And in the early 1880s, she married him until she found out what he was like. He was in and out of prison. He was always stealing things. He was well known to the forces of the law. He was in fights, but against that, so he, you know, he, as you say, he's a complex character. He was also fabulous company. He could tell a story, you know, in the corner of a bar that would go to midnight and absorb people. He'd win bets by his ability on horseback. You know, I wagered £5 that I can take this horse blindfolded. Jump over that gate lit by candles. You couldn't do that. Yes, I can. Well, they gather around and he would do it. So his legend went up and down the country, most particularly the east coast of Australia. And at one point, Banjo Patterson's uncle writes to Banjo and says, look, there's a bloke coming your way. Blake Moran, I don't know what's wrong with this bloke. There's something wrong with him. He's always in trouble, but look out for him. And sure enough, he goes down, Banjo Patterson looks up from his desk one day, and there's a guy saying, my name's Breaker Morant. They have a fabulous afternoon's conversation. Banjo recognises that Breaker Morant actually has genuine writing ability, writing poetry, very good poetry. And at the end of the afternoon, Breaker says, oh, look, I'm a bit caught short for money. Could you possibly loan me £10? And Banjo Patterson says, no, that's all right. You know, basically, he'd been forewarned. But that was the beginning of a long friendship that went for, well, in fact, Banjo Patterson then became a correspondent for the Boer War. He was the Sydney Morning Herald's correspondent for the Boer War. And it was only after Breaker Morant's atrocities emerged that Banjo Patterson certainly distanced himself from the whole Breaker Morant thing. But yes, they were contemporaries. And as you would have noted, were you interested in the fact that, you know, Winston Churchill was a figure in the book? I found him fascinating. Mahatma Gandhi was at the Boer War, all of that stuff. And a lot of people, I think, probably don't appreciate what the Boer War was about. Essentially, it was two white tribes fighting over the land of the native Africans, the black Africans who were the original owners of the land, the traditional owners of the land who were there. But what happened is the Dutch got to the southern tip of South Africa and settled it from the early 1600s. The Brits wanted it. The Brits came themselves when the port of Cape Town became important as the maritime power. To have a place halfway on the way to Asia that you could pull in, that was important, pushed the Boers out. And the Boers that were then pushed to the north of what we now know as South Africa. And then the devastating thing, the Brits were happy for the Boers to go up there and live their life out in the northern reaches of what we know as South Africa until they found diamonds and gold. And at that point, the Brits wanted to have that land themselves. And so there was endless tension between them. There was the First Boer War, which went in the latter part of the 1870s, first part of the 1880s. And there seemed to be settlement, you know, that armed neutrality, if you like, everybody get on with their lives. But then in the latter part of the 1890s, it flared again. And this time, the British Empire said, basically called for her sons from around the British Empire, come and fight. And among those who went to fight was none other, and this is important for the book, if not for the rest of the world, but my grandfather, Frederick Harper Booth. And I had the extraordinary episode for myself when I was on the Council of the War Memorial, the Australian War Memorial. I voted in favour of putting money towards the building of a war memorial for the Boer War. I went to the opener in 2017. I came, got out of the car, walked towards this wonderful bronze sculpture of four Boer War veterans with their horses, troopers, and there's a plaque in front of it. And the plaque was written by an Australian soldier from the front line to his mother about reporting what it was like, and they were the words of my grandfather, Frederick Harper Booth. And so that put in mind, you know, I've got to write a book on it to honour my grandfather. I've got all of his diary. We've got the family's all of his diaries and letters. He fought at one point in the same battle as Breaker Morant, and that was the beginning of the book. And, you know, using three or four researchers, two PhDs, one of them's a PhD in military history, trying to get to the bottom of what actually happened.
the Boer War is perhaps not very well known in our history studies, but when you think of all the things that came out of it, even in the language, you know, like there's we talk about the relief of Mafeking, we talk about commandos, we talk about the scorched earth policy. All these things were first raised in the Boer War, which are another fascinating
The scorched earth policy was deeply upsetting. Well, certainly was deeply upsetting for the Boers. But in essence, what happened was, the way the Brits fought, you know, a huge experience of fighting wars in Britain, if you're fighting a European nation and you take their capital, well, that's the end of the game. You know, we've got your capital. We've occupied your capital. You have to surrender. You know, you take... And what happened there is they took there were the two Boer republics, and they took Bloemfontein and they took Pretoria, and the Boers said, well, we're going to keep fighting. At which point the Brits said, well, if you keep fighting guerrilla warfare and are living off the land and are living off the Boer homesteads, the farmers who still give you the food so that you can still fight against us, we'll burn those Boer homesteads down. And they did. An estimated 30,000 Boer homesteads were burnt down. And it was quite upsetting. You know, one of my grandfather's letters, he writes to his mother, my great-grandmother, Maria Sophia Craigie McPherson Dunn Booth, and says, well, you know, today was very tough. We had to burn down this Boer homestead. The women and children were weeping, but Mum, you know, this has got to be done. This war won't be over till they're all done. And what then happened was even more appalling. They were rounded up and put in British concentration camps. And now, this was the beginning of the concept of concentration camps. And the actual idea was not the German idea, which ended up being the appalling, appalling is not a strong enough word, horrifying, scarifying, disgusting final solution, which was, you know, put them in the concentration camp and kill the Jews. This was not like that. This was, we'll round up the women and children and we'll have them in the one place at the one time in tents, and we can give them, you know, we can work out, you know, keeping alive food till the war was over. But the problem was there was insufficient sanitation. They were in flimsy tents. Dysentery took hold, disease took hold, and they died. And they died in appalling conditions. And one of my researchers is very strong on the ground, and she's very, you know, she's helped me a lot in saying, well, you're a male writing fundamentally male stories. What's the female angle here? Where are the female stories? And one of the heroines of my book is Emily Hobhouse, a wonderful English woman who comes to South Africa, goes to the concentration camps, is appalled at what she sees, goes back to England and raises hell, basically, signs, you know, launches petitions, goes to see people like Lloyd George, who became a British Prime Minister, saying this is disgusting, this must stop. And by the time we get to 1901, most of the Boer War is over in terms of huge masses of men clashing with each other, but the Boer commandos are still out there, and this is where Breaker Morant comes into play, because Breaker Morant joined the Bushveld Carbineers, as they were called, which was one of the units living off the land, riding hard, firing fast, and going out after these Boer commandos. And this is where the atrocities began, where at one point a man that was very close to Breaker Morant was killed in what I think was a fair fight. His friend Captain Percy Hunt launches an insane attack at midnight on a Boer stronghold. He's shot. Breaker Morant is told, rides hard, the body's buried by the time he gets there, but he hears that he's been mutilated. He swears vengeance on those who've killed his friend. They capture one of the men that was in the Boer commando that was involved in the fight, and Breaker Morant says, well, we're going to shoot him. What do you mean we're going to shoot him? We're going to have a court-martial right here and now, found guilty, and shot him. And he starts giving orders, and he is indeed shot. And this is the beginning of prisoners, of Boers, some of whom surrender and come in. You know, the idea is, all right, we'll lay down our arms, and because they can no longer live out there because all the food's gone and the homesteads have been burnt. And Breaker Morant, not shooting them himself, but Breaker Morant giving the orders for them to be shot, and so they were. And it's horrifying stuff, but for me, when I go into these sort of books, I try to find the most pedantic expert I can who's been living the story for years, and I found him. His name's Frank Shields, and he's in his late 70s, and he's been working on the story for 50 years, and he helped me a great deal. He vetted every paragraph that I wrote, and he said to me at the end of it, and he did his own book 30 years ago, and he said, well, you've added something to this beyond the new information. You've added something to it that it's never had before. And I said, what's that? And he said, anger. You're angry about what Breaker Morant did. And I bloody well am angry about what Breaker Morant did, but the unsung heroes, and I hope that I'll be interested to build what you thought of this, but the unsung heroes are the decent Australian soldiers who said, we're not going to do this. We're not shooting. We are not going to be part of an outfit that shoots unarmed prisoners, which sees, you know, women as bullets fired upon women and children, including killing of the children. This is disgraceful. This is not who we are. And 14 of them got together, led by a New Zealander by the name of James Christie, got together, wrote the letter that saw Breaker Morant and his closest accomplices arrested, tried for their lives in a court-martial. And did you pick up on that, that the whistleblowers were the actual heroes of the peace bill?
Well, yes, look, there is the other side of this, and you also go into some detail about the Battle of Eland, which is when the Australians distinguished themselves. I wonder if, on the good side for a minute, you could just talk a bit about the battle of that battle.
Battle of Elland River.
Yes, that's it.
Well, that was in the early part of the war, and see, this was a war that was made for Australians in terms of, it was in the First World War, I guess you wanted people that were very good at digging trenches. You know, in the Boer War, you wanted people who could live off the land, who were good on horseback, who could fire a rifle over a great distance, even at full gallop, and hit people, who could take shelter behind rocks, come up, fire off a shot, get down. And this was the Australians. They were very, very good at it. And in the Battle of Elland's, and they were fierce too. So in the Battle of Elland's River, at one point, 300 Australians were atop this small hill, and they were surrounded by Boers, and there was 200 English and Rhodesians with them. They were commanded by an English colonel, Colonel Hoare. What happened was they were attacked by 2,000 to 3,000 Boers who had heavy artillery, who pounded the bejesus out of them, but the Australians didn't give up. They had coal miners with them for a start from Queensland who knew how to dig and dig quickly. So after, you know, they hold them off for the first day, all through that night they're digging fortifications to get away from the shells, and they hold on. And then when the Boers start to attack, they fire back at them, and they put men forward out, and they shoot back. And after 4 days of this, the emissary comes forward from the Boers to say to the English colonel, you've got to surrender. We've got you surrounded. You can't possibly live. Here's the deal. Lay down your weapons, hand over your weapons and your ammunition and your supplies. We'll let you walk out of here. You'll live. And the English colonel says, you don't understand. I don't want to surrender, but even if I do, I could not. If I go back up that hill and tell those Australians that I have surrendered, they will slit my throat. And you can see from the diaries and letters of the Australians, he was about right. They would have. They would have shot him themselves. I don't know the slitting of the throat, but they refused to surrender. And they held on for an extraordinary 11 days until they were personally relieved by the personal forces of Lord Kitchener, who came, and none of the Brits under Kitchener, and Kitchener himself, could not believe how they'd held on, how they'd dug down. And it was basically Australia's Gallipoli before Gallipoli. It was something that Australia was proud of, that this could be done. And when I say Australia, I mean that at this point, we were right on the cusp of federation at this point. They were known as the Australian troops, but they were there as part of colonies, you know, the colony of New South Wales, Queensland, Victoria, WA, SA, and all the rest of it. And it was a magnificent effort that all across the colonies were very proud, and it was the beginning of the reputation of Australian soldiers.
We might take a short break. We always ask our guests to pick a song. Peter, could you tell us which song you've picked?
I love Bob Dylan. Everything that Bob Dylan ever wrote, I love, but there's no better song than Idiot Wind.
Someone's got it in for me. They're planting stories in their prayers. Whoever it is, I wish they cut it out quick. Lucky. He
And that was Idiot Wind, which was specially chosen for us today by our guest Peter Fitzsimons. Idiot Wind by Bob Dylan, of course. We're talking about Peter Fitzsimons' new book. It's just been released, called Breaker Morant. So, Peter, there was initially a court of inquiry before the court-martial, but I guess the lies that Breaker Morant had told all his life came back to haunt him when he actually got into the witness box.
Yes, and he was not good. You know, see, it was a thing of... The problem he had was the other witnesses, the brave troopers that were there. I mean, he'd done what he was done, and there was no denying it. It was a bit similar, you know, the scene of A Few Good Men where Jack Nicholson says to Tom Cruise, Tom Cruise says, "Did you order the code red?" And Jack Nicholson, Colonel Nathan Jessup, famously replies in the movie, "You're damn right I did. We live in a world that has walls. Those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's going to do it? You listen." And the scene in the courtroom was remarkably similar to that, because they begin by talking, the British prosecutor talks about Visser, who was the unarmed Boer prisoner that was shot on the orders of Breaker Morant, which was the first of the Breaker Morant atrocities. And, you know, Breaker Morant says, well, we gave him a court-martial, and the British prosecutor says, and this is made famous in the Bruce Beresford film that was out in 1981, was really well done, and it was based on the actual dialogue where he says, well, was it a court-martial like this? And Breaker Morant says, like this? No, I should say it wasn't like this. It wasn't comfortable like this. There were no tables and chairs like this. We were out on the felt, and you ask, under what rules did we shoot them? We got them, and we caught them, and we shot them under Rule 303. Referring, of course, to the rifles that they used. And it was the Breaker Morant way of saying, how dare you bastards question what we did, you know, out in the Badlands. We did what we did to live to survive. And that is the, you know, defence that he offered. But you can't explain away 20 of them, mate. You know, they were the atrocities that were done on your watch, and shooting unarmed prisoners is disgraceful, and it's not the way Australians fight. And that was what was so impressive about the 14 men that put their signatures to the letter that said, this is a disgrace to Australia, this is not what we do.
And the solicitor who was representing Breaker Morant, Major Thomas, you know, he was a solicitor, a country solicitor, and he's all of a sudden in a court-martial where he knows nothing about military rules, so it was pretty tough for him.
And very sad. And the thing about Major Thomas, he was from Tenterfield, you know, he was really affected by the case because he was entirely out of his depth. He was not a good lawyer. One of my researchers is a lawyer, at least has a legal degree, and was fascinated in the ins and outs of the actual way, the manner of defending. And he was out. I mean, look, there was no defence for what Breaker Morant did. And, you know, to this day, there are people that say he should be pardoned and the rest of it. Mm. Actually, no. The people, rather than pardoning Breaker Morant, the people that should be honoured were the decent troopers who said, this is not what we do. And I hope, I mean, the end of the, like, there were so many stories and so many angles to it. Again, if I can bring out, I mentioned Emily Hobhouse, the woman from the British activist, the English activist who came and tried to stop the concentration camps. I also tried to bring to life the story of another fabulous woman, Annie Boiter, who was the wife of one of the great Boer generals, General Louis Boiter, who said, I want this war to stop. And the husband said, well, we're not stopping. We're going to go till the last man. She said, no, we're not. I'm going to see Kitchener. And she did. And she became an emissary herself between the Boers and the English, going between Kitchener and Louis Boiter, bringing them to the one table at the one time to begin to discuss peace.
Well, at the getting towards the end of the story, Breaker Morant and Lieutenant Hancock, at least I guess they went to their death bravely, and that's brought out in your book. They actually were holding hands. They weren't handcuffed, which I was surprised at.
No, and it's very interesting. Again, the film is at least... Well, look, I mean, again, I think that Bruce Beresford film has lasted remarkably well. You look at it now and you go, gee, that's a good, fine piece of cinema. And Bruce Beresford never wanted Breaker Morant to turn out to be a hero. You know, he didn't show him up to be a hero particularly. But the information, see, the advantage I have over previous authors, like all of my books, is, well, one thing, I'm using three or four researchers. For another thing, I'm in the age of the internet, where I can get into archives around the world via the net, via my researchers, and bring to the surface documents previously unseen, collate them, and, you know, really try and work out exactly what happened. But yes, I live for, as I mentioned, FD, fine detail, the fine detail to bring a story to life. And the story of their death, you know, the last night, Hancock and Breaker Morant slept in the same cell together. Well, in fact, there was very little sleep going on, because Breaker Morant, while Hancock wrote to his sister and just about nobody else, Breaker Morant spent the night writing poetry, letters to people's last will and testimony, and then as come the dawn, so come the footsteps, bringing them from their cell. And they're taken out into the prison courtyard of Old Pretoria Jail, there against the wall are the two chairs for them to sit on. And they walk out towards these chairs to the death that they know is coming as the firing squad's there, holding hands, a moment of curious intimacy in something like that. But they're offered the last cigarette. Breaker Morant offers his cigarette, takes out a cigarette, offers the cigarette case to the sergeant major who's in charge of the firing squad. And the detail that I love the most, he knows when he finishes that cigarette that the order will be given to ready, aim, fire, and his life will be over. So you would think, would you not, that in a situation like that, you'd smoke that cigarette till your fingers burn, not Breaker Morant, with extraordinary chutzpah, if that's the word I'm looking for, probably not. He flicks the cigarette away when it's halfway done, goes to the cobblestones, and the wisps of smoke are blown away in the light dawn breeze. And he famously says to the firing squad, "Shoot straight, you bastards. Don't make a mess of it." And so they shoot, and he is killed, and he is executed. And it's a staggering tale.
Look, just one of many staggering tales, all coming from this new book, Breaker Morant, by our guest, Peter Fitzsimons. I'd like to tell everybody you can listen to this show again or any of our shows by going to our website, dadsontheair.com.au. If you'd like to send us an email, again, go to that website, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And it just remains for me to give a special thank you, Peter Fitzsimons. Thank you very much for once again being a spectacular guest on Dads on the Air.
Okay, Bill, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Peter. Bye.